Well met, and welcome to episode 20 of the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for November 22nd, 2009. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com. Greetings. This is Bill Walthall, and this week we're going to continue our month-long discussion of the second part of Henry VI with DVD reviews of two different television productions. We'll also be reviewing the Shakespeare's Globe Theater touring production of Love's Labour's Lost, and we'll do our usual recap of this week's blog entries. We have two DVDs to review this month. As usual, we have a production from the early 1980s, the BBC Collected Works series, as well as the second part of Henry VI segments from the 1960 BBC Shakespeare's An Age of Kings. Well, let's start off with the Collected Works production. As part of the Henry VI sequence, it has the same director and much of the same cast as Henry VI-1. This production, done in 1983, like Part 1, was directed by Jane Howell, who, if you remember, also helmed the Titus Andronicus from this series. Henry VI-2 is less tonally schizophrenic than Part 1. There is less overt comedy in this part, and what there is comes early. For example, Margaret leans in for a kiss from Henry in the first scene, but he kisses only her hand. While the same kind of title sheet is used, there are no play horses as there were in Part 1, and the laughs from both the Conjuration and Cade Rebellion sequences are not broad, but more wry and sardonic. For example, during Cade's first address to the mob, Dick the Butcher's asides can be played in a number of different ways. The asides can be played to Cade and his cohorts as if inside jokes between Cade and his inner circle, or to the camera as ironic observations on Cade's statements. The former can be played for laughs, the latter less so. Howell goes with the latter method. The acting is, across the board, solid. I still have the same issues with Peter Benson as King Henry. He's just way too old. But as a standalone piece, the casting works here as he plays his age as weakness and feebleness. Julia Foster as Queen Margaret is wonderfully spoiled, presumptuous. Now, she isn't the most attractive woman in the world, and after the death of Suffolk, her face ages and it falls, becoming even more pinched, even less attractive, and that definitely works. Bernard Hill's York grows from righteous, he wants what's best for the country, to self-righteous, to ambitious, to smilingly villainous. It's nicely done, a very good piece of evolutionary character making. Howell also does some interesting things with double castings, actors playing multiple roles. Anthony Brown plays both the frightening pirate murderer Walter Whitmore and the more placid and philosophical Christopher Iden. David Burke gets to go from the virtuous and innocent Duke of Gloucester to the lowlife Dick the Butcher. And moving from the Sheriff of London to Jack Cade is our old friend Trevor Peacock. Yep, the same actor who was our Titus back in August and our Talbot last month becomes the rebel who dominates the fourth act. Needless to say, he's very solid in the role. And finally, we get a glimpse at villainy to come with Ron Cook as York's son Richard, the hunchback who will be Richard III. Howell also shows a deft touch with little moments throughout the play. Suffolk is more explicitly Margaret's lover. She touches him constantly through the play. In the scene in which York convinces Salisbury and Warwick to join the cause, when Warwick makes his Kingmaker reference, he hoists a young boy onto his shoulder. The boy has a brace on one leg. It's obviously young Richard. And in Act 4, Scene 1, with the pirates, it has a real sense of tension and fear, and its ending, with Suffolk's final speech cut off, literally, offstage by the falling axe, it's perfect. She also uses the quarto edition of the play, which adds more dialogue to the final combat between York and Clifford. It's a little too much dialogue for my ears, but the folio's sudden jump into the fight is just too abrupt. All in all, Howell's direction is excellent, the performances are strong, and it's just a damn good production. Okay, so that was the early 80s BBC Collected Works production. Let's transition to the 1960 BBC Shakespeare's An Age of Kings sequence of history plays. Like all but Henry VI Part 1, the second part of Henry VI is broken into two episodes, The Fall of the Protector and The Rabble from Kent. The first hour, The Fall of the Protector, focuses on the downfall of Gloucester as it's brought about by those around him, from his wife to the Queen and his cousin Cardinal Winchester. Since we're dealing with early TV here, it's not technologically cutting edge, and the acting is fairly stilted and presentational. Of the two segments directed by Michael Hayes, this is definitely the weaker, despite standout performances by Edgar Rufford as an appropriately villainous Suffolk, Terry Scully as an appropriately weak Henry, and an appropriately ambitious Jack May as York. He's villainish, but he doesn't descend into mustache twirling. The two female leads are of note as well. Nancy Jackson's Eleanor is young, attractive, openly ambitious, and just hoping that her husband will go along with her desires. Mary Morris's Queen Margaret, while scheming, is the vision of nice. And with a full production, this might work, but here, truncated as the text is, her niceness just seems out of place. We need to see the juxtaposition of her likability with her cruelty. And since we don't, at least not in this half, it doesn't work. Now, the only scene that needs discussion here is the conjuration sequence. It's a wild, crazed bit. It's not meant to be comic, at least I don't think so, but it straddles that unintentional laugh line throughout the scene. So as I said, this first hour is not as strong as the second hour, so let's skip ahead to that one. The rabble from Kent is basically the second half of the play, the Jack Cade half, and stylistically it feels different. From its opening image, a close-up of Gloucester's face as he's being choked to death, it feels more realistic, less stagey. This is continued later in the piece, during the Battle for St. Albans, when director Hayes employs rear projection to depict a landscape of fire and fighting. It breaks the action out of the visually very visible television studio, and it's an improvement. There are also quite a few choices made in this episode that make it more enjoyable. Suffolk and Margaret's sexual relationship is played to the fore, with their hand-holding during Henry's collapse and their virtual make-out session during their long, tearful goodbye. The wild, over-the-top depiction of the conjuration is extended to Winchester's deathbed sequence. Winchester is majorly delusional and is all over the room, not eating, but devouring the scenery. Of course, it doesn't make any physical sense. He's dying, after all. But it was fun to watch. In this half, Jack Cade, played by Esmond Knight, is very comic, very Falstaffian, and the asides are played to each other rather than the camera. The rebellion itself is more comic than disturbing or dramatic. And then the final face-off between the Battle of Albans turns out to be a great verbal showdown that introduces Richard III as Smartass, wonderfully played by Paul Daneman. So the two episodes are wildly uneven. The second, better than the first, but still entertaining. Both the BBC Collected Works series and Shakespeare and Age of Kings are available on both Netflix and Amazon. And starting this month, I'm willing to say both are recommended. Okay. So the DVD reviews for the second part of Henry VI are out of the way. Now let's change pace and gears a little and talk about a production I had the pleasure of seeing last weekend. Last Saturday night, I took my wife Lisa and our daughter, a former student of Lisa's and a current doctoral candidate in English at UCLA, Lisa and my alma mater, up to Santa Barbara's Granada Theater for a performance of the touring production of Love's Labour's Lost by Shakespeare's Globe Theater Group in London. Now, in recent weeks, the reviews for the production have been mixed, to say the least. The common thread was that it wasn't a deep production, not reverent enough for some too rushed, others balked at the physical mounting of the production itself. More on that later. So I went in hoping for the best, but prepared for the worst, and resigned to only having a nominally entertaining night. I've never read the text, that'll roll around just about Valentine's Day of next year, nor seen a production. Not even Kenneth Branagh's almost universally panned cinematic quasi-musical version. I was coming into this cold. And for that, I'm kind of thankful. I was able to experience the play completely fresh, with no text-based expectations. Was the production great? No. Was it horrible? No. Was it even bad? Nope. It was good. Very good. I was neither blown away nor surprised, but I left with a smile on my face. Love's Labour's Lost is a difficult play, one which we'll discuss, needless to say, in greater detail once this current historical tetralogy is over. Since it doesn't have a clear or successful resolution, it's not produced very often, and thus it's not well known. And let's face facts. Part of the ease of producing Romeo and Juliet or Hamlet or A Midsummer Night's Dream is knowing that the audience has more experience of the plot and characters coming into the theater. So a director can cannibalize that a priori knowledge, allowing it to fill any blank spots in the production. A kind of directorial security blanket, if you will. Not so in this case. So here's the elevator pitch for the play. Ferdinand, King of Navarre, vows, with his three best buds, to concentrate on their studies for the next 3 years, and forsake women for the sake of these studies. The Princess of France and her three BFFs arrive and complicate matters. Throw in some horny rustics and a silly Spaniard, and much wackiness ensues. Now, as directed by Dominic Dromgoole, the characterizations were broad and not very subtle, but the performances were solid, though some of the actors' voices carried better than others. and the actors were directed to use as much of their bodies as possible to convey their meaning. This makes for a physical play, one that became more and more physical as the night wore on, to the point of a climactic food fight near the end. And given the amount of wordplay in the text, or at least the amount that I could gather from a first listen, that's a good thing. A couple of performances stand out. Fergal McElroy as the rustic clown Costard was fantastic. Short but physical, verbal and totally invested in the text, he conveyed the meaning of each and every word masterfully. In physicality, he was matched by Soroka Davis's Moth, the Spaniard's page, though her voice could have used some more oomph. Both Michelle Terry's Princess of France and Philip Columbus's Ferdinand were wonderful, both proper in their demeanor and clear in their performance. Paul Reedy as Don Armato, the wacky Spaniard, was excellent, though his accent drifted far east of Spain and more into Borat's Kazakhstan, and I think that was a conscious choice. Better to make him more of a generic wacky foreigner than a stereotypical Spaniard. The staging was simple, very globe-like, with a raised loft area, a recessed area, and multiple pathways for entrances and exits, including through the audience. The set construction was simplicity itself, painted flats and canvas hangings. All old school, all effective. The thrust stage allowed for no curtain, and to accentuate the feeling of the old globe theater, the house lights were left on throughout the play. Now, some critics have balked at this attempt, questioning its effectiveness. Sure, it doesn't replicate the globe. Only unbathed groundlings, food, no seats, and close quarters are going to accomplish that. Not that the tight seating at the Granada didn't try. But it did change the vibe of the proceedings, and it did give us all the same experience, which to me is just as good. The costuming was, in period, a kind of faux Elizabethan, I suppose, and it worked for me. Now, of course, as a guy, I could have gone for more heaving bodices. I'm a scholar, I ain't dead. But since the four main female characters were French aristocrats, I wasn't expecting Liz Taylor and Taming-type bus lines. The use of quasi-Elizabethan music in the play, performed live on stage, usually from the upper loft area, was as well integrated as I've heard in a long time. Now, I've heard some critics balking at the edit, saying that the pre-intermission section runs all the way to the end of Act 4, and thus it guts the play. I can't speak to that, at least not yet, but if it did, I didn't miss it, especially as this was my first experience with the play. Was the play comprehensible? Absolutely. Though maybe not comprehensive, that whole broad, not too deep criticism. But did I laugh? Yeah, I did. And for a comedy, isn't that what really matters? So I recommend this tour by Shakespeare's Globe, which continues in Southern California and New England through the end of December. More information can be found at shakespeares-globe.org. Now, if you've enjoyed this podcast, but you haven't been following along with our daily blog entries this week, you've missed out on subjects including Love's Labor's Lost Review, the short version, Meet the New Salisbury and Warwick, Henry VI's is History, Part D, Historical and Military Timelines, More Historical Inaccuracies, a discussion of the sources, and Buddy, Can You Spare a Quarto? So, if you would like more in-depth discussions, or just want a daily fix, check out the blog entries at thebillshakespeareproject.com or at our Facebook page, though the Facebook page is more for Shakespeare news than the daily discussions of our play of the month. Also, if you have any question or comment about this or any other Bill Shakespeare Project podcast or blog entry, you can always lob me an email at bill@thebillshakespeareproject.com. And of course, please join us again for our next podcast. We hope to see you then. Been listening to the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for November 22nd, 2009. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com, and we shall see thee anon.